This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
You're listening to the 1A podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for Jen White, and today we have something special for you. We're bringing you our latest installment of our local spotlight series, along with the first episode of the podcast, Murder in Boston, the untold story of the Charles and Carol Stewart shooting. For this episode of Local Spotlight, we speak with the host of the podcast, Adrian Walker. Adrian is also the associate editor and a columnist at the Boston Globe. You can find the rest of the podcast episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The HBO documentary series Murder in Boston, Roots, Rampage, and Reckoning is also available to stream on Max. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy: family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
On October 23rd, 1989, Charles Stewart called 911 from his car phone.
Boston, record emergency 510.
My wife's been shot. I've been shot.
Where is this, sir?
I have no idea. I'm off. I've been coming from Tremont, Brigham and Women's Hospital.
This is the moment where the podcast Murder in Boston begins.
Where are you right now, sir? Can you indicate to me?
No, I don't know. He made us go to an abandoned area.
Okay, sir, can you see out the windows? Can you tell me where you are, please?
No, I don't know. I don't see any signs. Oh, God.
When police found Chuck and his pregnant wife, Carol, the white couple were in critical condition, bleeding from gunshot wounds. Chuck was conscious enough to describe the shooter, and dispatch quickly sent out the word.
Black male, 30 years of age, black running suit with a white stripe.
Now, Chuck survived, but his wife and their unborn child later died, and what followed was a police and media frenzy. Here's Adrian Walker, the host of the podcast that tells the story.
This story taps into a primal American fear, that of an innocent white woman, pregnant no less, dead at the hand of a black man.
Adrian Walker was a rookie reporter at the Boston Globe when Carol Stewart was killed. In the aftermath, police tore through the predominantly black neighborhood of Mission Hill, searching homes and men on the street looking for a suspect. They arrested two people who both turned out to be innocent, because the killer was sitting in the front seat. Chuck Stewart set the whole thing up. This all went down over a few months in what became known as Boston's hot summer. But 35 years later, a lot of the story was still untold. Reporters at the Boston Globe spent several years investigating the case. The result is the podcast Murder in Boston, which was co-produced by HBO Documentary Films. Host Adrian Walker is with us today. He's also an associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe. That's where he's talking to us from. Hi, Adrian. Welcome to 1A.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. You were less than a year on your new job at the Boston Globe when Carol Stewart was killed, those many 35 years ago. What do you remember about that time in your city?
Well, it was a really intense time. You know, it was a time when there was a great deal of anxiety about crime. Murders were spiking, which had begun in the mid-80s. And so there was a lot of anxiety, and this crime tapped into it right away. And what I think I remember, and what all of us who were covering it at the time remember, is the sense right from day one that this crime was different, that there was just an added level of intensity to it.
You've now worked at the Globe for almost 35 years, as I mentioned. Long time.
Yes.
What made you decide, though, to dive back into this case?
You know, what happened was that in 2021, I believe it is, we had a group of reporters who were doing some terrific stories about police misconduct involving the Boston Police Department. And our investigations editor, Brenda McCarthy, had the thought that, you know, there was a history of this misconduct in Boston. And it went back, it went back many years, and he kind of traced the evolution of it back to the Stewart case. And it was a case that I had written about over the years, particularly in my role as a columnist. So, you know, he kind of called me up one day. This is when the newsroom was closed because of the pandemic, and said, do you think there's a project in the Stewart case? And I said, yeah, absolutely there is. And that was sort of the beginning of it.
This case made national news. I'm not from Boston, never lived in Boston. I remember hearing about this case a long, long time ago. But your reporting now uncovered a few major new findings, including that 33 people knew that Chuck Stewart was responsible for his wife's death before the cops did. And that's shocking, but it's even more troubling in the context of how law enforcement treated Boston's black residents as they searched for the killer at the time. Don Juan Moses was a kid in Boston at the time.
I feel like when they first heard this case, 1, 2, 3, they just knew that you was near the projects. You said a black man did it. That's all we need to know. Raid the project, flood the projects, get everybody out. I want lineups regularly. I want them to be able to tell us which one looked like who and so forth. That's all they was in mindset for. Put somebody to the case.
Adrian, what other stories did you hear from black residents of Mission Hill about police treatment at that time as they searched for Carol Stewart's killer?
I think the most shocking thing we heard was just the stories about all the searches that were being conducted of black males, especially young black males. In the center of Mission Hill, there's the Tobin Community Center, which is, as the name implies, a big community center. And, you know, it was a big place for after-school programs and things like that. And young men going in and out of that place were getting searched, I mean, strip searched on the street, on Tremont Street, routinely during this time. It was really appalling.
The Mission Hill neighborhood in Boston was the target of law enforcement, as you described, and you described the community center there as cops search for Carol Stewart's killer. Tell us a little bit more about that community at the time.
You know, Mission Hill is a very interesting community. It's sort of racially mixed, but it's a home to two large housing projects, including the one next to where Chuck and Carol Stewart were found on the night of the crime. And it had its issues with crime, certainly. But it was not known as a particularly dangerous or violent place. It was always sort of an unlikely setting for this kind of murder. And that was one thing that people were pointing out even at the time.
What is the long-term impact of the police department's treatment of the black community during that time? What's the impact been on the people who lived through it and the city at large? Because one thing that the Globe's reporting and your podcast makes clear is that the legacy of this case is not from the 80s. It's alive today.
Oh, very much so. And, you know, you talk to people who went through it, especially relatively young people who went through it, who are, you know, 50 now, and you really hear how people still really carry this trauma with them every day. It's become this unforgettable experience for them. And that was also one of the things that drew me to the story over the years. I had talked to people like Don Juan Moses and Ron Bell and Tito Jackson, who were also in the show. And, you know, when the talk turned to Stewart, it was amazing how vivid it was for them and how the pain of it never seemed to get any less. The shock of what they went through never seemed to lessen.
Just before New Year's in 2023, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu issued a formal apology to Boston's black residents and two men wrongly accused of the 1989 murder of a white woman.
On behalf of the Boston Police Department, the mayor's office, and the entire city of Boston, I am so sorry for the pain that you have carried for so many years. What was done to you was unjust, unfair, racist, and wrong.
Say it again.
That's the mayor of Boston there, Michelle Wu. Joey Bennett is the nephew of one of the men falsely accused.
And we just want to express our gratitude to Mayor Wu for the apology. Her courage in acknowledging the wrongdoings of the Boston police and offering a sincere apology is something we deeply respect and appreciate. It takes great humility and courage to acknowledge someone else's wrongdoings and to try to make amends. Your apology is accepted.
Yes, sir.
Your apology is accepted. Your apology is accepted.
Thank you. Your apology.
Joey Bennett's uncle, Willie Bennett, was wrongly named as a suspect in the killing of Carol Stewart. In fact, Carol's husband, Charles, also known as Chuck, eventually became the main suspect, but he committed suicide before he was arrested. The mayor's apology came in the aftermath of a major Boston Globe investigation into the case. Associate editor and columnist for the Globe, Adrian Walker, is with us. He's the host of the podcast Murder in Boston, the untold story of the Charles and Carol Stewart shooting. Adrian, you wrote about Mayor Wu's apology in your column in the Boston Globe. What did it mean to you personally? And if you can speak for the city a little bit.
Sure. It was a very powerful moment. I've been to plenty of events at City Hall over the last almost 35 years. And it was one of the most remarkable ones I've really seen. And, you know, the thing about Mayor Wu's apology was that it was so direct. It was so, she didn't pull any punches. She said it was racist. She said it was unjust. She said all the things people had been waiting to hear for all of these years, you know. And, you know, there have been other mayors over the past 34 years who never wanted to say anything about this, never wanted to touch it. So I really, you know, give her a lot of credit for that. And, you know, it was a room full of people who had been affected in one way or another by the case. People from Mission Hill, people, you know, people in the community, people, who had touched it in a lot of different ways. And it really meant a lot to the people in that room to finally hear somebody say, this happened, this was awful, it never should have happened, and I'm truly sorry.
Adrian, Boston was the city of busing, the city of busing riots, the city of black school children being assaulted by white mobs. Can you put Carol Stewart's murder and the response that it got from the cops, from the public and the media into this larger context of Boston's racial divide?
Yeah, absolutely. So the busing thing that you refer to begins in 1974 when a federal judge orders the Boston Public Schools to desegregate for many, many good reasons. And it sparked an immediate, you know, huge racial conflagration, this idea of sending black kids to school in South Boston and white kids to school in Roxbury. And, you know, school buses got rocked. There was racial violence. And all of a sudden, black people could not safely walk down the streets in multiple Boston neighborhoods, including South Boston and Charlestown. And that violence persisted. That violence went on through the 70s, well into the 80s, and was just beginning to kind of subside when this happened. And I think it's important also that context is important in thinking about why Chuck Stewart's story resonated with so many people. You know, it was a city that was already sort of this racial tinderbox, as Neil says. You know, they were just beginning to get past it. And as he says, it was a spark that they had always feared.
And you can hear it behind his voice there, sort of, here we go, kind of knowing the situation that they were in at the time. Well, a colleague of yours at the Globe, Aline McNamara, made a note of the hysteria around Carol Stewart's murder, and she was curious if any other people had died that night who weren't getting the same level of attention that Carol Stewart had. And there was a man named James Moody. She wrote a story about him that appeared on the front pages of the Globe.
There were no cameras clicking, no mini cams rolling at the city morgue when Sandra Williams identified the body of the man who shared her apartment near Franklin Park. James Moody, 29, was shot to death only a few hours after a robber attacked Carol and Charles Stewart outside Brigham and Women's Hospital Monday night. But no calls were heard at the State House for tougher sentencing practices. No news conferences were convened to mark lone black man's passing. And no mayor called about my loss, Williams said as she waited yesterday for Moody's mother to arrive from Memphis to take her son's body home.
Adrian, what response did the Globe get for running that story?
Well, there was a tremendous amount of blowback for running that story and for equating the death of Carol Stewart to the death of James Moody. You know, of all the stories we did back then, that story was always one of the ones that I remembered most indelibly just from the day it was published, because it was so important and so powerful. And it really it showed right up from the very beginning of this story how race played such an important role.
Adrian, your podcast team interviewed one of the police officers, Billy Dunn, involved in searching for Carol Stewart's killer. He described meeting the man who was eventually falsely accused. His name is Willie Bennett.
So we're going through the projects one night, and we know Willie was out. And we see a guy standing in a dark doorway. And we didn't recognize him, but he looked familiar. So I pull up, "What's your name?" "You know my name. I know your name." I said, "Well, what's my name?" He said, "Dunn." I said, "Very good. Now, what's your name?" "Willie." I said, "Willie Bennett?" He said, "Yeah." So I said, "Geez, I heard a lot about you." And he said, "I heard a lot about you. And if you get in my way, I'll kill you." I said, "If you get in my way, I'll kill you. I think I'll kill you first, because you just gave me the heads up. So I don't trust you, ever." And I said, "Get out of here." So he left. He walked. Walked away. He had a hoodie up. And that's the first time I met him.
Let's hear what happened when police settled on Willie Bennett as a suspect. Officer Dunn, who you just heard from, and Bennett's niece and nephew told this story on your podcast, Adrian.
The media gather across the street from Homicide and follow the police to Mission Hill in a caravan with cameras rolling.
As I lift up the shade, I can just see a line of men with big shields in their hands just marching down the hill.
That's Sherita Bennett, Willie's niece. That night, she was 7 years old, watching TV with her grandma.
I looked, I said, "Ma," I said, "there's some people coming down the hill. They're police." But before she tried to get to the window, that's when we heard the banging. So there was a door that you had to get in before you could actually get to the house door. So we can just hear them just banging and banging and banging on that.
The cops take a sledgehammer to the door. They're looking for Willie, but they'll take what they can get, whether that's evidence, interviews with family members, whatever. And guess who's leading the charge? Billy Dunn.
I was there. I knocked on the door. I knocked on the door, announced police, and then I stepped back and they hit the door. People didn't open the door.
Didn't he just see that sledgehammer in his hand? I'm not f***ing crazy. He had to hit that down. I remember him hitting that down. He had that in his hand, told me he's gonna bust somebody in the head with it. So they hit that door. And when they hit that door, that's when all hell broke loose. You see what I said? They had the shields and the black masks and the hoodies.
So somehow, someway, they managed to get in.
The Bennetts run for the door.
And as we're coming down, they're already in, coming up the stairs, pulling us down the stairs. And when we finally got down the stairs, they told us to sit on the couch. So as we're downstairs, they all just rush upstairs. At this point, we can hear like the guns clicking from the guns they had. So we could just hear the guns click, 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 and they're just yelling, "Freeze, freeze." And at this point, they're just ramshacking the whole house.
Well, Adrian, we just heard it there. Why did police suspect Willie Bennett of being the guy who murdered Carol Stewart?
Well, it's sort of a convoluted story, but four teenagers, including Joey Bennett, are gathered in an apartment together after school a day or two after the shooting. One of them thinks he hears Joey say his uncle Willie did it. It gets back to a woman who knows a Boston police officer. From that police officer, it gets to Homicide. These young men are all taken to Homicide and questioned, and that's how Willie Bennett ends up becoming a suspect.
Because of rumors among a couple,
yes,
of teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to head to a quick break. Back with more in a moment.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Amgen, a biotechnology pioneer leading the fight against the world's toughest diseases such as cancer, heart disease, asthma, and osteoporosis. In a new era of human health, Amgen continues to accelerate the pace of change, operating sustainably and drawing upon deep knowledge of science to push beyond what's known today. With each decade, they reliably deliver powerful new therapies to patients. Learn more at Amgen.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Support for NPR and the following message come from Bombas. Bombas makes absurdly soft socks, underwear, and T-shirts. And for every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness. Get 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/NPR and use code NPR.
Adrian, I'd love to hear a little bit of insider info on how you did it. What resources did it take to pull this multimedia project off?
Well, I'll just say that I thought it would take 1 year and it took 2 years. I'll start with that. But it took a lot. We had a terrific team of reporters and editors and later producers who helped us, you know, craft this. As you said, this, it's a print series in the Globe. We thought about it right from the beginning as a podcast. So we all had to learn how to make a podcast. And we were also working with HBO on their documentary. So, you know, there were a lot of moving parts.
At first glance, you think it fits into the true crime genre, right? Which is extremely popular. If you make a true crime, people are going to listen. But that your podcast, and to an extent the HBO miniseries, doesn't really do that. It doesn't focus so much on the Stewarts. It doesn't focus as much on Chuck Stewart and his treachery. He was the suspect. He was actually, I think we can evidently, allegedly, safely say that he set it all up and he was the murderer in the end. It really focuses on the police and the community and the effect on the Black community. True crime is off to the side and the community is in the front.
Yeah, and that's one of my favorite things about the project. It's one of the things I'm really proud of, is that the community of Mission Hill is really front and center. And we thought about it that way from the very beginning. I never really thought of it as a true crime story per se. I was always interested in the legacy it had in the city and the way it affected so many people who were involved, most of whom had never gotten a chance to tell their stories.
What were the most challenging parts of pursuing this investigation? I have to think that you knocked on some doors of some people who just definitely were not interested in talking about it or talking to you.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And one of the things that's interesting is that a lot of the people who wouldn't talk 34 years ago still won't talk. And that's particularly true of people in the Stewart's immediate orbit, their friends, their family. A lot of them are still maintaining their silence.
You also talk about, and a lot of writers have talked about, sort of the collective amnesia among white Boston. I mean, the 35-year legacy of this story is real, but much more alive in the Black community than it ever was in the white community. I mean, you've described sort of a collective forgetting, a willful forgetting among white Boston after this case kind of resolved.
Oh, yeah. There was this huge passion in the immediate aftermath to move on. You know, let's just, you know, this was all too bad, but now we just have to move on and get on with our lives. And Ray Flynn, I have to say, who was mayor at the time, Ray Flynn really led that charge. And I think white people were happy to forget it. And people in law enforcement, who of course were hugely embarrassed, were happy to forget it.
And some of them in the cops have forgotten it. But we, just in a second, we heard from Billy Dunn there, the detective. As I understand it, Billy Dunn hasn't forgotten. And in fact, to this day, is pretty sure he had the right guy at Willie Bennett's house. He's never repented.
No, he still thinks Willie Bennett was involved somehow. But the problem is they can't explain what somehow means, right? There was never a shred of evidence that Willie Bennett was involved. There is no evidence that Willie Bennett and Chuck Stewart interacted with each other, intersected with each other, met each other in any way. And so these people say, well, I still think Willie Bennett was involved somehow. And Dunn is not the only person who says that.
One of the findings, Adrian, in your reinvestigation of Carol Stewart's murder is that 33 people knew that her husband was involved or responsible before the cops did. And two of those people even attempted to tell the police but they were ignored. And your team spoke to Chuck Stewart's barber. He wasn't in the loop, but he did have like a really, really chilling story to share. And this is from episode 5 of Murder in Boston.
So when I looked up and then it was his picture, I was like, expletive. I can't believe it. My wife comes, she goes, what's my call? That's my client. And she said, what do you mean? I said, that's my client. I've been cutting his hair for 2 years. And she said, no way. And I said, yeah way. And I couldn't wrap my head around it. I couldn't. And my wife said to me, what's freaking you out? I said, I didn't even know this guy was married. I said, in the 2 years I've been cutting his hair, I never even knew that he was married.
Will also was surprised when his receptionist told him Chuck was coming in for an appointment, just hours after wrapping a months-long hospital stay. And when he walks in,
he didn't look all that bad. If I remember, he had a cream-colored shirt on and like a down vest, or he had some kind of a vest on or something, jeans, very, very unlike what I had ever seen him dressed as before. And I said, come on with me. I said, we'll be in this room. It'll, you know, be a little bit more private for you. And that way it'll be a little bit more quiet. And he was very, very subdued compared to, you know, whenever he came in, he always had a smile on and his eyes were bright. And when he came in, he was just very like down here. So I take him into the room and hang up his jacket or vest, whatever he had on. And I go in there and I close the door. And it's like, what do you say to somebody that has just been through that? You know? And so he's sitting in the chair and he's looking at me in the mirror. And I just said, Chuck, I just let me say this. I said, I'm so sorry for your loss. I said, I can only imagine what it would be like if my wife and daughter, if something happened to them. So I can only imagine, but I don't know what you're going through. And I'm just so, so very sorry for your loss. And he's sitting there and he's looking in the mirror. He doesn't react. And then he goes like this. See these gray hairs over here? Can you cover these up? I was gobsmacked. I was like, sure, I can do something with that. I said, I have a couple of things that I can do. What do you want to do? He says, I just want to make sure that these grays are covered up. It was just, he kind of sat there. We didn't really talk. I, you know, did his hair, colored his hair, cut his hair, you know, cleaned it up, asked him if it was okay, showed him it with a mirror. He said, no, that looks really good. Thank you very much. He finished paying with the receptionist. And he put his jacket on, and then he shook my hand. And when he shook my hand, he palmed me a $100 tip. And I was like, whoa, that's kind of freaky, you know? And then he was gone.
4 months after the shooting, Chuck was seen stepping off of a bridge in Boston. His suicide came shortly after police identified him as a suspect. So, Adrian, what do we ultimately know about the responsibility that he did have for his wife's murder?
What we know is that his brother Matthew went to police January 3rd, 1990, and identified Chuck as the killer of Carol Stewart and explained how and why he knew that. And early the next morning, at about 6:30, Chuck jumped off the Tobin Bridge. So that's what we know. He left a note that didn't really explain very much, but that was sort of the end of the case.
And he never, there's no record of any side conversation or anything that he said to anyone else that he was responsible or connected or anything like that?
He did have a conversation with the attorney who was representing him, but we don't know what was said in that conversation.
Yeah, privileged. Well, your reporting, as we said just a moment ago, revealed that 33 people knew that Chuck was involved, responsible for the homicide, before the police did. How did you get to that number 33, and what did they know? I mean, he didn't go around to 33 people saying, I did it, right?
He didn't, but yet this was probably the single most surprising finding to me, easily the most surprising finding to me. You know, Matthew knew, and Matthew told his girlfriend, and everybody, you know, other people told someone else who wouldn't tell anybody. One of his brothers was a firefighter in Revere, and told several family members on a recorded line. We've heard the recording. And, you know, it just trickled out over time.
His brother Matthew involved tangentially, not with the murder itself, but admitted to being involved in sort of a side plot, which was some insurance fraud and kind of helping his brother Chuck stage this thing.
Well, yeah, he and a friend disposed of the gun the night of the murder. And he may have been more involved than that.
So two people, as we mentioned, even tried to tip off the police, but they were ignored. What happened there?
The police just kind of blew off the tips. You know, the first homicide detectives who were involved in the case, Bob Tinlin and Bob Ahern, immediately suspected Chuck Stewart as a prime suspect. I mean, they interviewed him in the hospital. They thought his story didn't add up. They didn't believe anything he said. They get pulled off the case as the police brass decides to immediately buy into this narrative. Chuck has told them that it has to be the skinny black man in a tracksuit. And really, they never considered any other possibilities, which is, you know, it's appalling and it's heartbreaking, too, because it means that everything that happened after that was avoidable. They just never really considered anything other than believing and buying into Chuck Stewart's story.
So two people did try to tip off the police. That leaves 31 people who didn't. What do you make of that number? I mean, it sounds like omerta. It sounds like just a code of silence among all of these people in a way. I wasn't there. But what do you make of 31 people who didn't say a word?
I think code of silence is an apt way to describe it. I mean, all of them were family members or people who were adjacent to family members. And I think they just decided not to talk about it. And significantly, they still won't talk about it. You know, we knocked on the doors of these people, the ones who are still around, which most of them are, and they're still not talking.
Well, let's hear what happened when the public found out that Chuck Stewart was indeed responsible. People were so angry at police and angry that they easily believed this lie that a black man had killed Chuck's wife.
Some politicians and media figures had called the black man Chuck described an animal. Nation of Islam minister Don Muhammad pointed out the hypocrisy.
And there are some public officials who gave credence to that. I want to know now, will you call Mr. Charles Stewart an animal?
The city suddenly felt like it was on the brink of violence. Again, Police Commissioner Mickey Roach.
I was preparing for a riot. That's how serious it was in this city. You know why? Because the same people who had so much compassion for the DeMatey family, Carol Stewart, the child, suddenly there was only one emotion that they could have, and that was rage. There was no other.
Boston Mayor Ray Flynn visited the home of the family falsely accused at the time.
He went to the Bennett home, where just weeks earlier, police had banged down the door and ripped the place apart. He was ostensibly there to apologize. Willie's sister, Vita Bennett, says she had been knocked down the stairs during the raid, and she met with Flynn when he visited.
He came to the house. I offered him a seat. He said, no, thank you. He told me, like, our house was nasty and dirty. That's how he looked at us, like we was dirty people. I said, that's all right. God's going to punish you for that.
I was locked up, so I wasn't even there.
Joey Bennett was still in jail the night Flynn visited, but he heard about it.
Flynn came in the house. They wouldn't even move. They wouldn't go into the living room, sit down or nothing. They stood in front of the same door that they let get tore down. You could, the ramming hole was still in the door. They came in, they stood at the closet door and gave a half-ass, we're sorry, ma'am. Was sorry. That was it.
Adrian, talk a little bit more about that apology from the mayor at the time, because it stands in such sharp contrast to the one we heard earlier from Michelle Wu, the mayor now. I mean, just, you can't even call them both an apology, completely different experiences.
That's right. And, you know, you got to remember that Ray Flynn was this man who had built this reputation and become mayor, you know, due to this reputation for racial healing. And he certainly failed in that moment. I mean, the apology was so lacking that most people don't even remember that it ever happened. You know, there was nothing public about it. He just kind of walked in, said whatever he said to the family, and walked out. And again, as I said earlier, Flynn was, you know, really anxious to stop talking about the Stewart case and to just move on. And it's part of the reason that this has had such a lasting, you know, legacy of pain, the fact that it was just never dealt with at the time. And it is absolutely in stark contrast to the way Michelle Wu dealt with it a few weeks ago.
Adrian, your podcast does reflect on the role local and national press, including your newspaper, played in how the city and in some ways the nation responded to this case. What did the media get wrong about how it covered the story at the time? I mean, did it just pick up this easy narrative that Howard Bryant just described? Blame the black guy? That's easy.
Well, what I would say broadly is that we fed into the hysteria and helped pump it up. And yeah, I mean, a lot of the media absolutely did sort of run with that story. Now, it's not true that there were no skeptics and there was no skepticism, but that certainly wasn't the predominant voice. You know, the predominant voice was that some black man had done this terrible thing and the police needed to find him, and they had a suspect and then they had another suspect. And, you know, I've always said that the great lesson for the media from coming out of this was to just be a lot more skeptical about what you're getting from official sources, because it turned out there was much less to all of that than we were being led to believe at the time.
Do you think that has happened? I mean, I want to ask you, in Boston, and maybe let's scope out a little bit nationally, has the media in Boston improved how it approaches a story similar to this, or at least one with some of the same dynamics, if things change there?
Yeah, I think the media has improved so much. And we also just live in such a different environment now with social media and everything else. And if this happened now, I always say, you know, the critics of the police and the skeptics would have a much bigger microphone to make their voices heard, which is something that was lacking in 1989. That being said, I mean, one of the reasons we wanted to do this story is because I think it does resonate nationwide. I think things like this have happened in other places. We know that for a fact, you know, in police relations with black communities have been a problem, not just in Boston, but in cities across our country.
Well, we got this message from Beth in Maryland, who says, I was 20 in Boston attending college when the incident happened. I can't explain it, but I had a scary feeling that Stewart was lying, that he murdered his pregnant wife. After the cops tore through the black community without a thought, suddenly the news broke that Stewart was indeed the main suspect, and hours later, he jumped off that bridge. His lies demonstrated that Boston never lost the racism that many locals try to pretend doesn't exist. That's why Stewart thought his plan would work. And I think, Adrian, that that's pretty reminiscent of what Howard Bryant had to say about the ease of that narrative in the city of Boston at the time.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yes, it does reflect how easy it was to sell this story.
Well, you raised an important point in one of your columns in the aftermath here. I think one of the most important points as we look back, happened 35 years ago. Could a repeat, a version of this story in Boston happen now?
I mean, I don't think you can say it couldn't happen. It would certainly play out a bit differently. But, you know, I'd like to think that we are past this, but I'm not so sure. I hope we never have to find out.
Are there any dynamics still in the city that lead you to believe? I mean, I'm asking you to speculate a little bit. It's a little bit difficult. What's going on with policing now in Boston that still gives people pause about whether, not a carbon copy of this case, but assumptions about young black men, assumptions about the black community would lead to over-aggressive or bad policing?
I mean, I certainly don't think we're in the midst of a post-racial anything. And it's not just about policing. It's about the fact that these stereotypes about who commits crime, who commits heinous crimes, who should be suspects, all of that still exists. All of that is still in the water in Boston and, I believe, in other places.
Well, as we've said, murder in Boston is so much more than a true crime story. True crime in this story is there, but it's off to the side. This is a study of a community, a police department, a city, and racial groups in the aftermath of, yes, a horrible murder, but one that revealed so much about relationships and biases in the city of Boston, and definitely applicable, as Adrian Walker says, to cities, communities, all across this country. Adrian Walker, associate editor and columnist at the Boston Globe, podcast host of Murder in Boston, the untold story of the Charles and Carol Stewart shooting. Adrian, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to head now to a quick break. Back with more in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. AI may be the most important new computer technology ever, but AI needs a lot of processing speed, and that gets expensive fast. Upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. OCI is the single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. Do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic. Take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor E-Trade from Morgan Stanley. Take control of your financial future with E-Trade. No matter what kind of investor you are, their tools and resources can help you be ready for what's next. Now, when you open an account, you can get up to $1,000 with a qualifying deposit. Terms apply. Learn more at etrade.com/NPR. Investing involves risks. Morgan Stanley Smith Barney LLC, member SIPC. E-Trade is a business of Morgan Stanley.
You just heard our conversation with Adrian Walker, host of the podcast Murder in Boston, the untold story of the Charles and Carol Stewart shooting. Coming up is the first episode of that podcast. You can find the rest of the series wherever you get your podcasts. And the HBO documentary series Murder in Boston, Roots, Rampage, and Reckoning is also available to stream on Max. We'll let our friends at the Boston Globe take it from here.
The HBO documentary series Murder in Boston, Roots, Rampage, and Reckoning is available to stream on Max. The Boston Globe's full investigative series is available at globe.com/StewartCase. Before we begin, this episode contains some offensive language and descriptions of violence. It may not be appropriate for all listeners.
Boston, record emergency 510.
My wife's been shot. I've been shot.
Where is this, sir?
I have no idea. I'm off. I've been coming from Tremont. Brigham and Women's Hospital.
It's 8:43 on the night of October 23rd, 1989.
Where are you right now, sir? Can you indicate to me?
No, I don't know. He made us go to an abandoned area.
A man calls 911 from his car phone. He's lost somewhere in Boston.
Okay, sir. Can you see out the windows? Can you tell me where you are, please?
No. I don't know. I don't see any signs. Oh, God.
Chuck Stewart is in the driver's seat. His wife, Carol, is next to him. She's 7 months pregnant.
Okay, has your wife been shot as well?
Yes. In the head.
Moments ago, they were at a nearby hospital, taking a birthing class, preparing to welcome their first child.
Okay, so bear with me now. Stand by. Stay on the phone with me.
Chuck's from the suburbs. He doesn't live around here. All he knows is that he's on the wrong side of Huntington Avenue, and he's scared. He's crossed over this main artery of a road, gone past the dividing line. On one side of Huntington Avenue, you've got prestigious hospitals and fancy museums. Now, he's on the other side, in a mixed-race neighborhood called Mission Hill, a place that people from the suburbs know to avoid.
Okay, Chuck. Help's going to be on the way. Bear with me. Is your wife breathing?
Gurgling.
Chuck says a man with a gun forced him to drive here.
The people that shot you, were they in the area right there?
No, they took off. Oh, they left.
Okay.
Carol is bleeding out in the front seat beside him. They're racing against an unforgiving clock.
Oh, man.
Chuck, can you give me anything? Just look out the window. Can you see anything?
Oh, I'm blanking out.
You can't blank out on me. I need you, man. Chuck.
They're not the only people shot in Boston that night, but their story is the one that captures the attention of the nation for weeks. It will alter the image of Boston forever. It's something people here will be living with and talking about for decades to come.
Topping News 7 tonight, a brutal attack on a pregnant woman and her husband as they left childbirth classes at a Boston hospital.
The Stewart case was one of those news stories that exploded from inside your television set.
Several police officers said tonight the stakes have changed in the street wars.
I remember that evening saying whoever did this needs to go straight to hell.
It was the ultimate urban nightmare. An innocent white couple with a baby on the way, shot in the heart of the city.
We feel vulnerable because we are vulnerable. So many of us can see ourselves in the Stewart's car.
This was one of the most sensational crimes in the city's history, and it was all captured on tape. In a time before smartphones and 24-hour cable news cycles, it went viral.
From Boston tonight, we have a nightmare story of random crime and violent death.
A near wipeout of a family that came in from the suburbs. It is a dramatic and horrendous thing.
The hunt for the attacker engulfed Boston for months. The crime and its aftermath exposed truths about the city and the country few wanted to confront. Race, class, crime, and punishment. The city's raw nerves were exposed. Everyone thought they knew what happened, but what you believed depended on the lens you brought to it. Boston's simmering tensions were about to boil over.
Everything is building up to this moment in terms of how we really felt about each other. And this was the stick of dynamite that finally went off.
Like, life switched just that fast.
Nothing's gonna be the same again. That's what I said to myself. I knew at that moment.
You can't make this shit up. Oh, but they did make it up.
My name is Adrian Walker. I'm a columnist and associate editor at the Boston Globe. I was here when this happened. I saw it on the 11 o'clock news that night. And as a young reporter new to Boston, this was a holy shit moment. People were talking about race wars, martial law, the death penalty, all kinds of crazy stuff. They called the shooter an animal. As a transplant from Miami, I'd already been told that my experience in Boston would be different because I'm black. Back then, colleagues warned me to be careful going into certain neighborhoods, like South Boston. I'd covered crime in the city already, but this was different.
I think it's the biggest embarrassment in the city of Boston, and they want it to go away.
But it never went away for me. I thought I knew this story inside out, but I've learned there's much more to it. Our team of Boston Globe reporters has been digging up all the old files and uncovering new investigative findings.
How do you not come forward?
I feel like in any minute someone might come in and take things away.
It's absolutely crazy.
Stay with us. We're going to tell the story in a way it's never been told before. We're going to tell the story the right way.
I still feel the coverage has never really been done properly. They don't have us, who it happened to, side of it. And it basically boils down because they didn't really give a shit about us.
This podcast is a look at the quintessential Boston story, a place where race and crime, fact and perception, all collide in a tragic way. And it all begins in Mission Hill.
I'm a speaker pawn.
This is Murder in Boston, the untold story of the Charles and Carol Stewart shooting. Episode 1, The Crime.
I'm at 100% of agreement of being able to help document about something that should have been spoken so long ago. This just shows that what you put under the rug, it sticks out to someone cares like you guys to come pull it out, to be examined. And that's what I'm happy to be part of it.
Don Juan Moses grew up in Mission Hill.
Where this building is right now, where the third story is, that was a brick building. And we lived on the third floor.
7 Racine Court, apartment 38 and 39, here in Mission Hill when it was projects and bricks. It's just, you can't forget this.
What Don Juan sees walking around the streets these days is vastly different from what he saw when he was a kid here.
Right now, we have buildings, community centers, much bigger. We have condos. It was not condos and townhouses. This was just a dirt road. It was a big old parking lot, but there's dirt.
But one thing feels the same. The memory of the shooting of Chuck and Carol Stewart and everything around it continues to be embedded in this place and its people. It's certainly still alive here for him.
Telling you the truth now, looking at that building, Horizon Buildings, you can't ever forget that right there with that case. That's Charles Stewart case all day. Those buildings, no matter what situation changed around it, those buildings are still there.
Don Juan's in his mid-40s now.
I am 6'5", African-American, brown eyes, very passionate about everything I do.
He's a personal care worker in a hospice up in Maine.
And my hat says love.
There's a million hats of everything that's out there, but I'd rather be what you wear.
Don Juan's actually got a bunch of these hats. He buys them here, and he drives them back up to Maine. He gives them out to the hospice patients in his care.
I come back home to buy them. That's what I'm doing this weekend. If I can give it to those that's passing, let them know that they're going to die with love.
He's proud of how far he's come from these streets.
Grandpa gave me a challenge before he died. He said, be what you never had. Let it be seen through your actions, your clothes, and your words. So I became love, something I never had. And I helped kids in my state. He said you could become what you went through or overcome it.
His grandpa was talking about Don Juan's childhood in Mission Hill. Don Juan is the only one of his 8 siblings who didn't go to prison.
First one to touch foot at college, first one to graduate high school, or a second one after my brother, his high school diploma came in the mail after he got murdered.
It's no accident that this is where the murder happened.
All you had to tell somebody is where you came from, where you live. Mission Hill Projects, all right, I know who you are. You already got a label.
But let's back up, because Mission Hill has been a whole bunch of different neighborhoods over the years. It's like an archaeological dig. More than 100 years ago, this is where Irish, German, and Italian immigrants settled. It was working class and deeply religious. There's a big Romanesque revival church right in the heart of the neighborhood known as Mission Church. Anywhere you stand in the neighborhood, you can see its spires. People understand the geography of Mission Hill in relation to this church.
This is Tremont. Yeah, Tremont, because the Mission Church is up the street.
The public housing projects, called Mission Maine, were built between 1938 and 1940. At first, the residents were pretty much all white. By the early 60s, white people were leaving the city in droves and heading for the suburbs. Meanwhile, there was a huge influx of Hispanic people from Puerto Rico and black Southerners looking to flee racial terror in their own towns. Many started settling in Mission Hill, and by the 80s, the neighborhood had flipped to being mostly black and Hispanic. Lots of people talk about that time in really nostalgic terms.
It was just a happier time. People looked out for one another. You know, it still had the vibe where Miss Rudolph could tell Joyce Johnson's child to stop that. I'm gonna tell your mother. You know, it was a community. Everybody kind of knew you. You know, you knew, the kids knew the kids, the mamas knew the mamas.
Christine Norwood came to Mission Hill as a little girl in 64. She loves the place now, and she loved it back then.
People were outside, kids were playing, you know. Children were outside riding their bikes and playing and sliding up and down the cellars.
All the apartments had stairs leading from the sidewalk down to the cellars.
And then on each side was a slant so that they had packages, they could slide them down. Okay? Now the kids get cardboard, plexiglass, anything, and they slide down the cellar. Well, when you slide down the cellar, at the end of the cellar is a brick wall. Okay? So no mother wants you playing in the cellar. A lot of kids, no teeth.
But all that changed in the mid-80s when crack arrived. A major dealer from New York set up shop in Boston, and that was it. Crack was everywhere, along with heroin and cocaine. And the bit of sweetness of the early 80s was just gone.
Back then, it was easy to walk on the street and catch a crowd of guys. And if you wanted whatever it is they were selling, you could go up there and get what you wanted.
That's the Mission Hill that Don Juan's mom moved to.
It's like being entered into a jungle because it was so chaotic.
Don Juan was 11, a kid trying to understand the world, but growing up too fast.
My mom always told me, be home before the street light. I don't want nothing to happen to you. You got drug dealers every other corner, stuff hidden inside trees. They got kids being mules. I remember when I turned 12, the guy told me, just watch this tree. I'll give you $200. Just stand here and watch this tree. I didn't know what he was talking about or what it was, but I went home and told my mom about what just happened. She was like, and brought me back to the corner and said to the guy, don't ever do that again. I didn't even know what I did wrong. All I know, I was standing next to a tree, not realizing that I was playing possum for someone's stash, not knowing. I was just a kid, so it was crazy at that time. And walking through, you know, you got undercover cops, you got gangs moving back and forth.
Everybody belligerent, drinking, you know. It was hard being a kid at that age.
Don Juan tried to stay out of it. He said his basketball was his best friend. And when he wasn't on the court, he was squirreled away in the library.
I was running from kids not to get jumped, but I was sitting there and read, and I just stay in there and just read. Just stayed. I don't even know. The books talk to you.
But by the late 80s, the violence was all around him. There was no way to escape it.
And that's where the two heroin addicts fought in the alleyway, and the bullet shot through the window.
The bullet tore through his family's apartment.
It would have caught me in the forehead if I didn't kneel down to change the channel when I did. So people used to do things, wait right there at the corner for people to come down this hill, mug them, and then run back through there. A Caucasian man was in that trash can, in that dumpster. All I noticed was by his legs and his shoes. That was the first dead body I think we ever witnessed.
My whole dream was just to make it to 21. I didn't think I would make it. Between the police and the street? Nuh-uh.
As he walks through his old neighborhood, Don Juan catches sight of somebody he grew up with. They embrace.
What's up, man? I'm a survivor.
How you feeling, man?
I'm living, man.
I'm living.
Wow. It's been a while, baby. I'm glad you still recognize it, brother, man.
His friend is wearing a bright orange hoodie that reads, "I survived the 90s.
You see his shirt? I survived the 90s. I'm definitely getting a shot with him. I'm definitely getting a picture with him. I survived. Oh, my God.
Don Juan's old friend carries with him some of the same painful history of the neighborhood.
His cousin got shot and killed over here, in this building over here.
So this is Mission Hill in the summer of 1989, just before the Stewart shooting. It's a pretty brutal place, but it's also full of people like Don Juan who are just trying to make it through alive. No one has ever asked Don Juan about his story. Like many people we talked to for this podcast, Don Juan didn't think it mattered. After all, he had nothing to do with the Stewart shooting. He was just an 11-year-old kid.
I never thought it would mean anything. I just thought it was something in my archives that I had to just keep and see it as a layer of skin that I made it through it.
But everything that is about to be set in motion with Chuck Stewart's 911 call will directly impact folks like Don Juan and Christine Norwood. Everyone in Mission Hill has a story from that time. It was the beginning of what would come to be called Boston's hot summer.
Throughout this summer of 1989, police and city officials took the offensive with an aggressive campaign against Boston's gangs.
It's senseless violence generated by the frightening plague of drugs and guns in our society.
Boston's gang warfare appears to be heating up, and the city's neighborhoods are feeling the burn.
This wasn't totally new. The previous summer, a young girl was killed in another part of the city, caught in crossfire between rival gangs.
Tiffany Moore, at 12, became an unwitting victim of drugs, thugs, and Boston's turf warfare.
And it wasn't just Boston. In the spring of 89, a jogger was attacked in Central Park, and five black teens were blamed for the crime.
And in New York City, after a Central Park rampage of assault and rape by a pack of youths, police have learned a new term. Wilding.
There was an almost hysterical concern about violence in the so-called inner city. And really, city and suburbs were just a proxy for black and white. And all of this violence seemed to be connected to drugs.
This is crack cocaine.
The month before Chuck Stewart would make his desperate 911 call.
All of us agree that the gravest domestic threat facing our nation today is drugs.
Then President George H.W. Bush addressed the nation.
Our most serious problem today is cocaine, and in particular, crack. Who's responsible? Everyone who uses drugs, everyone who sells drugs, and everyone who looks the other way.
So, in 1989, the city and the country were on edge. Fear had helped propel so many families, just like Chuck and Carol Stewart's, to the suburbs. Everyone believed there was safety outside the city. And by October of 89, the Stewarts were firmly settled in, preparing their home for a baby. They pulled their blue Cressida into the parking garage at Brigham and Women's Hospital on a crisp evening. This was the most prestigious maternity hospital in the city, and also the most popular. Half of Boston was born here. It is on the fancy side of that Huntington Avenue dividing line, just a couple blocks away from the heart of Mission Hill.
I, like Carol, was pregnant in 1989, expecting my first child.
Kim Woodward and her husband were in the same birthing class that night, along with about 10 other couples.
We had been in the class just weeks, maybe 3-4 weeks. And we all felt like we were at that point where, okay, this is getting closer. And I said, you could bring your pillows next week. And it's like, oh my gosh, this is real.
Kim and her husband also lived in the suburbs.
We were all on the same boat, sitting there with our big bellies and our babies and all the promise of what that meant and, you know, what we were planning and what was coming up.
In class, she sat next to the Stewarts. Carol, in a white sweatshirt with her shoulder-length brown wavy hair, stood out.
I don't think I asked any questions. I didn't know what to ask, but Carol had a lot. She said, my doctor said I may need to have a C-section. So she had a lot of questions.
Kim noticed Chuck, too, for a different reason.
Her husband sat next to me, and I thought he was so nervous. He just really was out of it. And I was laughing with Steve on the way home. I said, that poor guy, he's so nervous. Can you imagine what he's going to be like on, you know, Labor Day when he has this baby?
The class ends around 8:30 p.m., and the couples head home in their cars. Around the same time, a couple miles away in the South End, paramedic Rich Serino is hard at work.
It was actually a very crazy busy day.
There was a fire at a high-rise that morning, and then a major car crash on the Tobin, the bridge that connects the city to the northern suburbs.
It was like cars hanging over the bridge.
Rich was in his 20s, just a couple of years on the job at that point. He grew up in Boston and knew the streets well. It had already been a long day when dispatch called.
And said, hey, do you want overtime tonight? And it's like, yes, absolutely. You know, take some overtime.
And this was a bit of a special assignment.
And they said, well, it's going to be probably taken around the Rescue 911 crew. It's like, yeah, okay.
That's Rescue 911. It was a popular new TV show. Its crew went from city to city, chasing ambulances and filming first responders in action. The show offered a blood and guts look inside real ambulances and ERs.
The footage that follows is not a recreation. It was taped during a ride-along with the Boston Emergency Medical Service.
So Rich has a camera crew with him in his emergency vehicle. This is critical and could be a blessing or maybe a curse. Because either way, Boston's biggest crime is largely captured by a TV crew.
I had this film crew sitting next to me and wired and mic'd up.
At first, the action is pretty routine. There's a stabbing in the South End, not the kind of drama the TV crew is looking for. Then,
I'm on Mass Ave and I start hearing down by City Hospital, you know, the reports. It was just something really different that was going on.
The dispatcher working that night sends out a call to emergency crews, including Rich's.
A blue Toyota Cressida. This comes in from a cellular phone. He's supposed to be shot. His wife is also shot at Huntington and Tremont.
Emergency dispatchers have a general sense of where Chuck and Carol are, not far from the hospital, somewhere in Mission Hill. But Chuck can't say exactly where.
I can't move. Oh, God.
Chuck, can you see anyone on the street? Pull over.
I'm looking. There aren't too many people.
Okay, calm down. Just hang in with me. I'm going to have assistance right there to you. Open the door and talk to anyone that passes by, my friend. Anybody at all. I want to talk to somebody. Find out exactly where you are.
The Boston Police Dispatcher is trying to locate where they are. And so they have a general sense of Brigham Circle, you know, but that's a large area.
Chuck, we're on the way, but you've got to tell me a little better where you are. I need a little better location to find you immediately. Chuck, can you open the door?
Yeah. Oh.
Where were you shot, Chucky? Hello, Chuck? Chuck, can you hear me, Chuck?
I left.
Precious seconds are ticking by, and Chuck has gone silent on the line.
Come on, Chuck, I can hear you breathing. Can you hear me, Chuck? Pick up the phone.
Several police cars are searching the area for the couple. The dispatcher, still on the phone, has an idea.
Hey, wait a minute.
sirens over there?
You hear the siren. I can hear a siren.
Cellular phone.
Chuck isn't talking, but the dispatchers can hear police sirens through the phone. They realize they can use the sirens to locate the couple.
Turn on your sirens and turn them off so they could hear through the cell phone where they were on the fly to triangulate exactly where this is and where the police cars were.
911, put on your siren now.
Negative on the siren.
Bravo, K1. Sound your siren.
Not yet, no siren.
Bravo, K1, shut off your siren. Bravo, 1-4, sound your siren.
And then, on the fourth or fifth try.
Definite location, we heard the siren.
We've located him in McGreevy and St.
EMS and Boston police arrive at the same time. A crowd is already starting to gather.
And there was the car. They were both still in the car. He was in the driver's seat. She was in the passenger side.
Serino and another paramedic get to work.
Kevin and I stayed with Chuck and started taking care of him. He kept saying over and over, you know, don't take care of me.
Take care of my wife.
Yeah, but tell me that people take care of her.
Their injuries are dire.
He had a pretty significant gunshot wound. You know, she had a gunshot wound to the head. We wanted to make sure that the baby gets to the hospital. You want to try to keep the mother alive. You have a woman who's in cardiac arrest. The horrific incidents, you don't stop to say, oh, this is horrific. You just go in and take care of people. You're in autopilot at that point.
When I got there, the scene was pure pandemonium.
Evan Richman was the first photographer there.
I was kind of the junior man, and I was working the late shift.
He was working for the Boston Herald and had been listening to the police radios.
And by the time the police dispatcher broadcast the location of the incident, I was only a couple blocks away.
He followed an ambulance to the scene.
People were leaning inside the front windows of the car. Obviously, the EMTs were leaning in to assist the victims.
TV cameras captured Evan there in the fray. You can even hear the click of his camera.
Hey, when you got that one?
Push back in, you're going to jail. Now push back.
He's so focused on taking pictures that he barely registers the tragedy unfolding in front of him.
When you're taking a picture in a fast-moving news situation like that, you're not always looking at exactly what you're photographing. You're thinking about the technical aspects, the focus, the composition, the exposure. I wasn't really looking directly at it like you would looking at a photograph. I was thinking about a lot of different things, trying to capture that image on film.
He doesn't know it yet, but he has memorialized a moment that will not only depict the horror of the crime, but come to define the worst of Boston.
It was all focused around a car, and I made a few frames of the car.
It's a close-up. The dark of the night lit up by a flash. It's as if you were sitting right on the hood of the car, looking straight through the windshield. Carol Stewart is slumped to her side. Her white sweatshirt is splashed with blood. Her dark wavy hair covers the worst of it. And Chuck, he's in the driver's seat, leaning back and grimacing, the white of his teeth in sharp contrast to the bib of dark blood on his shirt.
Did you know whether they were alive?
The woman seemed like she wasn't, or barely. She was in grave condition. I think that was evident. The man in the driver's seat was squirming around, making faces like he was injured, but he was evidently alive.
It's an image that we will still be talking about decades later.
He cut seat belts, he cut his clothes off. We went to get Carol out first, and then we were able to get him out shortly thereafter.
The Rescue 911 footage shows all of it. Blood, pain, panic. After Chuck's stretcher is loaded into the ambulance, a police officer leans over and speaks with him.
See who did this?
It's hard to make out, but the officer asks, who did this? Chuck says, black man.
One guy, two guys.
All right, what do you look like? Black man. What do you have on? Black coat. Any stripes on it? What color? Red. 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 Beard, mustache.
Chuck tells the cop the shooter was wearing a tracksuit with stripes on it. He doesn't offer much else, but it's enough to cement the image of the main suspect.
For that shooting at McGreevy in San Alfonsus, black male, 30 years of age, black running suit with a white stripe.
Chuck and Carol are taken to different hospitals. Carol goes back to the hospital they had left just minutes ago. Chuck goes to a trauma unit elsewhere. While all this was unfolding, a man named Louis Elisa is at an event at a Masonic lodge in Boston, an all-black fraternal organization.
We were all there at Prince Hall, 25 Washington Street. The room was filled with people, and we were having this really important ceremony.
Louis is one of Boston's leading civil rights activists, president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, and well acquainted with the powers that be in town.
I was a Mason, and I'm still a Mason, in Prince Hall Grand Lodge. And a number of brothers in my lodge, members in my particular lodge, were police officers.
All of a sudden, their police radios start going off. Everybody's getting called in. One of the officers tells Louis what's going on.
And he says there's a car that was hijacked by a person they believe to be a junkie, and he shoots the wife and the husband.
Right away, Louis knew this would not be a routine investigation.
He explained that there's been a shooting and they thought that the black person involved. I said, really? I said, so, you know, of course, I'm in my tuxedo and I'm going out to his car. I said, take me to the station.
They went to Area B, a police precinct not far from the crime scene.
So we come back to B2, the old station, and, you know, I get out the car and I go in and I see all these police piling in. It looks like one of those things that used to happen back to the civil rights days or in the Vietnam demonstration days. These guys, they got shields, they've got these batons, you know, they got shotguns. And I'm like, what? You know? And so I go in on the first floor and there's the desk. And then behind the desk, I think, is the night commander's, you know, space. And I said, you know, who's in charge here? And they said, well, the mayor's in the back.
Mayor Ray Flynn. He'd been Boston's mayor for 2 terms, and he had a habit of going to high-profile crime scenes like this. He and his boyhood friend, Police Commissioner Mickey Roach, were at the station giving orders.
And I looked at Mickey. I said, what are we doing here?
The mayor's bodyguard tried to shoo Louis away.
He says, you know, you don't need to be in here. This is not something that, you know, that you have anything to do with. I said, well, apparently it is because I heard that you've accused, you know, your guy's accusing a black person of shooting some white woman in the head, you know. I said, Ray, you need to take 10 Mississippi. You need to stop. I said, you're running in the wrong direction. He says, you don't know what you're talking about.
After failing to convince the mayor to slow down, Louis appealed to Boston's top cop.
I turned to Mickey Roach and I said, Mickey, you're the commissioner. I never forget that. I said, you know this doesn't feel right and it doesn't sound right. He says, what am I going to do, Lou? He's the mayor.
And the family, I was at the hospital tonight and the priest was there saying a prayer. And it makes you, breaks your heart to see this kind of situation.
Mayor Flynn rushed to Brigham and Women's Hospital, where Carol was clinging to life.
It's a tragic situation that everybody's heart goes out to the family.
Flynn held a hasty press conference late that night. He wore a green Boston Police warm-up jacket and stood next to one of Roach's top deputies.
My understanding is that the female is in serious condition, and as is the male, and I cannot comment further on the condition. I just don't know.
We understand that she was pregnant, and they were able to save the baby for a cesarean.
My understanding is that delivery was made of the child.
And the condition of the child?
I don't know the condition of the child.
Carol's baby was delivered by cesarean section that night. He was named Christopher. Both of his parents were in critical condition at the time of his birth. Chuck was in surgery, and Carol, she died hours later.
It's another example of the availability of guns that are so frequent. Seems like it's happening every single day.
We have a full investigation underway. We have no suspects in custody. We do have the description of a assailant.
At the press conference, Mayor Flynn turned the shooting into a citywide emergency, just in time for the 11 p.m. news.
I've asked the commissioner, I was talking to him a little while ago, I've asked him to put every single available detective in the city of Boston on this case to find out who the people or person who was responsible for this cowardly, senseless tragedy.
Every single available detective. There were shootings in Boston almost every night back then, but this was different. From the moment it happened, the Stewart case, as it came to be known, was considered an exceptional act of violence.
Authorities have identified the woman as Carol Stewart of Reading.
Doctors managed to save their baby performing an emergency cesarean section. The baby is also in critical condition tonight.
It led the news that night. And around that time, Herald photographer Evan Richman was back in the newsroom. His film had been whisked away from the scene and developed by a colleague. He hadn't even seen the photos yet.
I went down to the press room when they're just starting to print the papers, and I got one.
He was one of the first to see the front page.
It was shocking to see. It was very shocking to see. It's tough to look at. It's such a gruesome picture.
Chuck and Carol in the front car seats, covered in blood. Carol in the process of dying. Even by tabloid standards, the picture is extraordinarily graphic. In the morning, the entire city of Boston will see the gory crime scene. And in the days to come, they'll hear the dramatic 911 call again and again. Today, we've got phones and video cameras in our pockets. But back in 1989, you just didn't see a brutal killing like this up close.
The murder of Carol Stewart on Mission Hill Monday night is forcing all of us to confront something awful and real about life in our city in 1989.
Residents here are expressing another emotion, fear. Fear of a big city that's becoming increasingly violent and whose tentacles are now reaching far out into quiet suburban communities.
It terrifies white Boston and unnerves black Boston.
I just knew from that moment on that everything was going to be different, that this story would be like no other I've ever seen.
This story taps into a primal American fear. That of an innocent white woman, pregnant no less, dead at the hand of a black man. In Mission Hill, Don Juan remembers the impact was immediate.
You said a black man did it. That's all we need to know. Raid the project, flood the projects, get everybody out. I want lineups regularly. I want them to be able to tell us which one looked like who and so forth. That's all they was in mindset for.
It's out of the news, but it's still in my head.
Soon, police will knock down doors and strip search young men. They'll lead a massive manhunt. With Chuck's description, virtually every black male in Mission Hill is a suspect. And then, the district attorney ups the ante, appearing on a nightly talk show and calling for the death penalty.
Now the chase is on. Who did it?
So you knew right away that with the story about the black man jumping in the car, they were going to tear apart Mission Hill.
Oh, hell yeah!
That's on the next episode of Murder in Boston.
I'm a speaker upon.
Murder in Boston, the untold story of the Charles and Carol Stewart shooting, is presented by the Boston Globe and HBO Documentary Films. This podcast was reported and written by Globe journalists Evan Allen, Elizabeth Coe, Andrew Ryan, and me, your host, Associate Editor Adrian Walker. The project was led and also co-written by Assistant Managing Editor Brendan McCarthy and the Globe's Head of Audio, Kristen Nelson. Nelson served as Senior Producer. Melissa Rosales is the Associate Producer. Our theme music is Speak Upon It by Boston's own Ed O.G. Reza Daya is our sound designer. Voiceover direction by Athena Karkanis. Research from Jeremiah Mannion. Fact-checking by Matt Mahoney. The Globe's executive editor is Nancy Barnes. Thanks to former Globies Brian McGrory and Scott Allen, and to Boston Globe Media CEO Linda Henry. Additional interviews and audio courtesy of Jason Hayer and Little Room Films. Special thanks to Michael Gluckstadt and Allison Cohen on the HBO podcast team. The HBO documentary series Murder in Boston, Roots, Rampage, and Reckoning is available to stream on Max.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Bombas. Bombas makes absurdly soft socks, underwear, and T-shirts. And for every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness. Get 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/NPR and use code NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Lisa. Good sleep should come naturally. And with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Visit Lisa.com to learn more. That's LEESA.com.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me. And I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on Black experiences. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.